This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Als Gründerinnen und Gründer willst du vor allem eins, schnell vorankommen. Egal ob beim Product Market Fit, deinem nächsten Schritt oder deinem ersten großen Enterprise Deal. Doch mit KI, die Entwicklung immer schneller macht, steigen auch die Anforderungen an Sicherheit. Und das früher als je zuvor. Wer Themen wie Security und Compliance richtig angeht, ermöglicht Wachstum. Wer zu lange wartet, bremst es aus. Deshalb setzen viele Startups früh auf Wanta und wachsen sicher weiter. Wanta macht es einfach mit tiefen Integrationen, starker Automatisierung und kontinuierlichem Monitoring, das mithält. Und wenn es ans Audit geht, seien Wochen bereit, nicht erst in Monaten. Jetzt starten auf wanta.com. Als Gründerinnen und Gründer willst du vor allem eins, schnell vorankommen. Egal ob beim Product Market Fit, deinem nächsten Schritt oder deinem ersten großen Enterprise Deal. Doch mit KI, die Entwicklung immer schneller macht, steigen auch die Anforderungen an Sicherheit. Und das früher als je zuvor. Wer Themen wie Security und Compliance richtig angeht, ermöglicht Wachstum. Wer zu lange wartet, bremst es aus. Deshalb setzen viele Startups früh auf Wanta und wachsen sicher weiter. Wanta macht es einfach mit tiefen Integrationen, starker Automatisierung und kontinuierlichem Monitoring, das mithält. Und wenn es ans Audit geht, seien Wochen bereit, nicht erst in Monaten. Jetzt starten auf wanta.com.
BBC Sounds. Music, Radio, Podcasts.
Welcome to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. You, me, top experts, a virtual meeting room and 28 minutes. This week, should school exams be abolished in this pandemic academic year? There are plenty of casualties of COVID-19 and education in schools has been one of them. There was the massive examinations row in August, and the issue of what to do about children coming up for assessment in 2021 is now becoming urgent. In all four countries of the United Kingdom, the approach looks like being different, sometimes very different. So should we just abolish exams in this pandemic year? Come inside the briefing room and together we'll find out. Because education is devolved, we need to start by looking at the picture 7 months into the pandemic across the four nations of the UK. Branwyn Jeffries is the BBC's education editor. Branwyn, announcements this week suggest that some nations within the UK are taking different decisions about keeping schools open. Can you tell me what decisions have been made? And maybe we should start with Wales.
Well, in Wales, the whole country is going into a short, sharp national lockdown in which secondary schools, when they reopen after the half term, it'll only be for children in years 7 and 8. That's the first 2 years in secondary school. The other older pupils, including those studying for GCSEs, AS and A levels, will continue their learning at home for an extra week.
And in Northern Ireland?
Schools have closed for half term this week and will stay closed until November the 2nd.
So in both places, some school children will lose a substantial amount of in-school education as a result of this. Now, you made a reference to it, but more broadly, what educational provision will the children who are not going to school receive at home?
Well, it's going to vary enormously depending on children's home circumstances. Access to broadband, which has proved a massive issue during the first national lockdown. Also, whether or not they're having to share a device with siblings, whether or not their school has been able to provide them with one if they don't have one at home. There's also been huge variation in terms of what schools have been providing. Now, today in England, a new legal duty comes into effect in which schools have to provide remote learning for any children who are self-isolating at home. But there is a real shortage in terms of digital resources.
Going back to Wales and Northern Ireland, what do we know about their educational plans going further ahead? Have any decisions been made about how children are going to be assessed this coming summer?
Well, in Wales, they've said that they are looking very carefully at moving away from timetabled exams. We won't find out exactly what kind of alternative they're going to put in place until next week. Northern Ireland has said it is going to hold its main exams next summer. They're going to start a little bit later, but it still needs to come forward with its contingency plans.
Just give us an idea about why it's so important that those decisions have to be made now.
If you're going to alter the kind of questions, the content in the exams themselves, then schools want to know now, should they alter what they teach? Should they be gathering more evidence as they go along of how pupils are doing, just in case they have to fall back on reaching some other kind of judgment on their progress?
So in other words, it's tricky if you delay the decision much further. What about Scotland and England? What decisions have they made about assessment in the summer, if any?
Scotland has gone for a hybrid model. So National 5 exams, which are GCSE equivalents, are going to be replaced by a system where grades will be awarded partly on coursework, partly on teacher judgment. We're yet to see more detail of that, which again schools want soon. And they will allow the highers and advanced highers, so A-level equivalent, to go ahead. In England for the moment, ministers are saying that they want exams to happen with a three-week delay. But with the disruption we're seeing across the north of England, already there are some head teachers getting in touch with me to say they're not sure now whether or not there will be a level playing field, whether children who've already had to self-isolate maybe for 3 or 4 weeks this term will have the same capacity to sit exams as a child in another part of England which has had much less disruption to schools. There's no easy solution. And what many people are saying to me is that actually this cohort of students are in a worse position than those who were getting their results in summer 2020 because they did miss out on quite a large chunk of learning last year, and ahead they have a huge amount of uncertainty.
Branwyn Jeffries. Schools everywhere have now been back for about half a term. So what does the data tell us so far about how our children have fared? Let's start with England, Wales and Northern Ireland. Natalie Pereira is Executive Director of the Education Policy Institute. Natalie Pereira, do we have a good picture of what happened to school children during the lockdown across the country? Who lost what in terms of schooling?
We know that around 14 weeks of learning was lost for pupils in England, around 13 weeks for Wales, and 12 weeks in Northern Ireland, 11 in Scotland. And we also know that the extent to which pupils were able to engage in online learning has differed quite significantly. The hours of online learning were highest in London and the southeast and southwest of England, where around a quarter of pupils participated in home learning for over 4 hours a day. The home learning hours were lowest in Wales, Scotland, the Midlands and Northern England, where just 15% of pupils participated for 4 hours or more a day.
There was some laptop distribution, wasn't there? How did that go?
So it went really well in Wales. Now, obviously, Wales is a smaller country compared to England and has far fewer schools. But one of the things that we saw from how Wales approached it is that they were effective because the relationship between central government and local authorities in Wales, and then in turn the relationship between local authorities and schools, meant it was easier to facilitate the delivery of laptops.
And in England?
In England, the situation was much more difficult. There was no procurement process in place to get new laptops. So all of that had to be figured out from scratch. And there were significant delays in getting laptops to vulnerable pupils.
Is there any research to show what it is that pupils have actually lost in terms of their educational undertaking and how that varies? Putting it very crudely, have middle-class kids fared less badly than other kids?
Before the pandemic, disadvantaged pupils were just over 18 months behind their more affluent peers by the end of secondary school. And we expect that gap will only widen as a result of COVID-19.
What initiatives were put in place to help children who needed to catch up?
England has been the most generous in providing around £1 billion of catch-up this year. It's allocated £650 million of that billion directly to schools based on the number of pupils that they have, and said that they can essentially do what they feel is most appropriate to support their pupils to catch up. But they've also invested the remaining £350 million in a new national tutoring programme, which will increase the number of tutoring companies available to schools and subsidise the cost of tutoring by 75% this year. Where we think the government missed an important opportunity is that they didn't target the funding based on the school's level or the pupil's level of disadvantage. So whether you're a poor pupil or a more affluent pupil, you'll still attract the same amount of catch-up funding.
So actually, it's possible that that money might, if anything, exaggerate difference rather than overcome them.
It could do. We just don't know at the moment.
Can we talk about what's happened since schools came back? Are we at the same level of absences as we were pre-COVID?
In England, around 86% of secondary pupils were attending schools, whereas the figure was 92% for primary pupils. It's clear that secondary pupils have been more impacted. We know that in England, there's been around 4 to 5% of pupil absence these last few weeks, purely due to COVID-related reasons. We know that particularly those with special education needs and disabilities are more likely to be absent. But at the moment, there's very little data that's published by the Department for Education about vulnerable pupils. And it's really important that they do publish that data so that we can fully understand what's going on and think about strategies to help them catch up.
Natalie, what worries you most about the data that you've seen, and what is most reassuring to you?
What worries me most is that everything points to a widening of the gap between poorer children and their more affluent peers. Not much fills me with confidence in all of this, but some anecdotal evidence we're hearing from teachers are that children are really pleased to be back with their friends, back in a reasonably normal school environment. So that gives me some hope.
Natalie Pereira with the picture in England, Wales and Northern Ireland. What about Scotland? Lindsay Patterson is Professor of Educational Policy at the University of Edinburgh. Lindsay Patterson, what level of absenteeism has there been since schools opened in August?
It's been under 10%, usually around about 5%. It's more than it would normally be, but it's not absolutely astronomical.
During the spring lockdown in Scotland, how did the online learning go?
I don't think it went very well at all. Now, teachers put in enormous efforts to try to make it work. There was the question of engagement, and all the evidence we have, again, throughout the UK, is that only some children were engaging fully with the lessons. Now, if we look at the research on that, comparing different parts of the UK in the spring, we find that Scotland really was pretty poor compared to most other parts of the UK. Wales and the north of England weren't great either, but Scotland was right down at the bottom there. The effort that was made to engage with children in Scotland was not as systematic or as extensive or as determined as it was in most parts of England.
Do you know what level of learning loss Scottish children have had? Is it quantifiable?
Unfortunately, it's not, because the Scottish Government has not commissioned any systematic research on the loss that there has been. And so teachers are having to develop their own rather informal ways of working out what has been lost and how pupils would catch up. And because it's all more informal and there's been no national reporting of this, there is simply no standardised reported evidence on how much has been lost by Scottish children during the closures.
But you've had a catch-up programme. How's that been going, and what's it consisted of?
Well, the catch-up programme has simply consisted of government at various levels telling teachers that they have to enable children to catch up. There's no catch-up programme in the way that there is in England. It's really odd. I find it very puzzling. The public debate about education in England is far more intense and far more visible than it is in Scotland. That's a puzzle.
How Scotland responded to the fact that even if the size of learning loss isn't exactly known, that it has existed and it needs dealing with?
So that loss of time led the Scottish Qualifications Authority, which runs the exams, to propose to scale back the syllabus a bit. So that was their recommendation, that the exams would go ahead, but with less material and more choice. The Scottish Government then overrode that and said that the national exams should be completely cancelled. They cited in support of the cancelling of exams the report that they commissioned into what happened in the summer with the infamous algorithms and all that kind of thing. That report did recommend the cancellation of these exams, but provided no evidence about its effect or indeed why it would make a difference to students, apart from the fact that removing the exams would reduce some pressure on students and their teachers.
So how will assessments be made at National 5?
It's not at all clear what teachers are going to use or what the Scottish Qualifications Authority is going to use to assess young people, because actually the normal coursework of National 5 has also been abolished, as well as the exam. And the Scottish Qualifications Authority has said that they will, in due course, propose new types of coursework very soon, they say, that will be the basis of the assessment this year. But they haven't said what that will be yet, and they haven't said when that new type of coursework will in fact be communicated to teachers. So by the time this happens, let us say around about the middle of November or something like that, teachers will have been teaching a course for at least a quarter of the time without knowing how that course is going to be assessed. That must be incredibly frustrating for teachers, therefore very unsettling for students. They won't know whether the particular work they're doing, say next Monday, is actually going to count towards the eventual assessment.
Not ideal.
Not ideal at all. One of the arguments that has been put about cancelling the National 5 exams is that the National 5 is not the school leaving exam for most children. Three quarters of children go on beyond the National 5 to take hires, and therefore the higher exam result becomes their end of school assessment. But that leaves a quarter of children who leave school without anything beyond National 5. And that figure of a quarter rises to just about a third of children living in socially deprived circumstances. So children leaving school with only a National 5 are going to have, I think it could be argued, a devalued certificate this year. Now, that is going to disadvantage them compared with young people from previous years who do have an exam, or indeed future years, but it also disadvantages them compared with young people in England who will have a GCSE this year, which has been subject to normal examination assessment.
I hadn't realised any of that. Will there be curriculum changes for hires?
Yes, indeed. So at the top level exams, roughly equivalent to A-levels in England, the exam will go ahead, but all the coursework will be removed. So it's like the exact opposite direction of what is happening with National 5s. Normally, in most of the higher grade exams, with the exception of mathematics, actually, there is some coursework. Now, that's being abolished in nearly all cases. So the problem is going to be, if the exams and hires have to be cancelled again, there will be absolutely nothing for the teachers to fall back on to predict what students have attained.
Has the government provided a rationale for that decision about the hires?
No, indeed. In fact, the government didn't even announce that. You had to burrow down into a very large document from the Scottish Qualifications Authority that runs the exams to find that the coursework and the hires was being withdrawn this year. That was never announced, and therefore it's never been subject to any kind of public discussion whatsoever. It's simply been asserted that that was something that would reduce the amount of work that students would have to do in a very difficult year. That's the only rationale that's been offered.
Is there an active plan B should the pandemic mean that the higher exams are difficult to take?
No, there isn't a plan B. All that has been said by the Scottish Government is that they will review the situation regularly and they will take a final decision about whether these exams will go ahead in the middle of February when there's normally a school break. It's not at all clear what would happen if the decision is taken in February to go ahead with the exams and then there's a vast eruption of COVID, say, in April. That's not clear at all. After all, that was a situation we were in earlier in 2020.
Professor Lindsay Patterson. So there's a lot of variation in experiences and policies across the UK, even if the problem is basically the same. And you've heard what the Scottish Government plans to do to assess students this summer. But is that the best approach? And what will and should the other governments do? Anna Vignol is Professor of Education at Cambridge University, and Laura McInerney is an education journalist and former teacher and CEO of the education aid company Teacher Tap. Anna Vignol, we've heard already that England and Scotland have taken different decisions about GCSEs and National Fives. Who do you think has taken the right decision?
So at the moment, the two options being discussed are whether we have exams as normal or whether we cancel the exams and switch to teacher-awarded grades. In my view, I don't think either of those is going to work. If you take exams as the starting point, if we just set the exams that are normally set, we're going to have a problem because too many students will have missed too much school for the standard format to work. But equally, moving simply to teacher-awarded grades isn't necessarily the answer, particularly because of the huge workload it's likely to generate for teachers who are going to have to justify those grades. So I think talking about either of those two options as the only thing on the table isn't quite right. And I think we need to start talking about how we might change the exam system to better suit the circumstances we find ourselves in.
OK, we'll dig into some more of the detail on those in a moment. Laura, how do you weigh up the two approaches that the governments have so far seemed to want to take?
Well, as Anna said, there are problems in both cases. One thing the unions have pushed for is more optionality in the paper. That's where you might say to the students, actually, you can pick a number of questions. So if you weren't in for a certain topic, then you don't have to answer on it. But that's incredibly difficult to do because you then have to design an exam paper where all of the questions are the same level of difficulty. And of course, what you want across an exam paper is some easier questions and some harder questions so that it's more or less accessible. And that's how you differentiate the marks at the end. So the optionality feels like the best way to do it, but then it's almost impossible to design an exam paper that way.
Might having more coursework be a good idea, do you think?
I suspect that this comes down to how much you want to show that you've got faith in teachers. And so actually, if you're already doing coursework as part of the exam system, which is the case in Scotland, then there is every year an element in which the teachers grade some work and then somebody else checks a sample of that work to see if the grades are reliable. And as long as they are, then all of the students in that school get the grades their teachers give them. If they're not considered reliable, then those marks can be readjusted. So if you're doing that as part of the exam system normally anyway, I can see why you might feel that at a push, it's not a problem for 1 year only to extend that to everybody. But I don't think we can get away from the fact that it does bring with it problems of bias, but also did every student have equal access, for example, to the same amount of help when they were doing that kind of coursework? So that's one reason why particularly England and Scotland in the last few years have much reduced the amount of coursework, though Scotland has kept a little bit more.
Anna, Scotland has kept a little bit more, and as we know, coursework assessment has gone right the way down in England. Does it mean if you did do it, the teacher assessment route, it would be actually harder in England because we've lost, if you like, the habit of assessing as we go along?
Yes, gearing all that up again from scratch, right in the middle of a pandemic when schools are doing an amazing job of just keeping themselves open and keeping kids learning, doesn't seem to me the right way to go. I think the other thing is I'm probably more optimistic around adapting an examination to test different depths of learning. Now, obviously, it is difficult to design an exam that can do that, but at least the work would be being done by the exam boards rather than by the schools. And what schools could do in the interim is have some confidence that fundamentally the curriculum is not changing and that at the end of it, their pupils will not be disadvantaged as much as is possible by the fact that they haven't covered a particular topic due to, say, self-isolation due to coronavirus.
Now, I'm trying to weigh up what that means in practice that you both think the governments should and could do at this point. In England, we know that the government has said, we're going to press ahead with the examinations, maybe change them a bit, but with a 3-week delay. Laura, how helpful is that?
That 3-week delay doesn't massively help if you've missed out on lots and lots of parts of the curriculum. And actually, what I worry about with the 3-week delay is it encourages teachers to think that their job is to just make sure they taught absolutely every topic, even if it was only once, so that when the exam comes up, they can say, well, you know, I did my job. I made sure that you learned about X thing, but that student didn't get it in any depth. And the depth of the knowledge is so important. And if there was a way to design the exams so that there were fewer topics, it would be a better thing.
I think I'm really beginning to get a handle on this now, which is the necessity for not saying this is a normal year. This is an abnormal year, and we're going to have to reconstruct the assessment at the end to take account of the fact that it's been so abnormal. I mean, Anna, is that broadly it?
It is exactly right. And I think, you know, one of the issues we've not talked about is whether or not you would go the full hog, if you like, and say this is such an abnormal year that we will set exams at the end of it. We will assess students' knowledge, but we're not going to give the same grading system as we would do in a normal year. We'll call it something else, just so that you can still have an assessment, but you're not trying to compare it to previous years. I've given long and hard thought about that. The problem with that is it will disadvantage this cohort going forward into the labour market.
I think one of the problems is that the GCSE grades in particular act as an entry gateway. So, for example, to train to be a teacher, you need to have a certain grade in English and maths at your GCSEs. And it's very difficult if a year group or even a couple of year groups go through and they don't have that standard, but they apply to be a teacher in, say, 10 or 12 years from now. So there is a labour market problem, which you want to try and resolve by keeping the grades looking very, very similar. So it might be a combination where you explain to people, this isn't the same as other years. It's been done differently, but nevertheless, we're trying to give a set of grades that look similar so that, you know, there's no labour market problem in the future.
And it may be that anyway, we don't really have any alternative to doing that, Anna.
That's right. I mean, you know, we are where we are. As I said, we're making decisions now. We don't know what the future holds even during the course of this year. And the problem with messing around with the exam system at this point is that it's going to be a massive distraction. It's going to cause uncertainty. I do appreciate that many people argue that GCSEs are stressful and that, you know, people have questioned whether we need them. That's fine. I don't think making such a major policy decision as abolishing GCSEs is a good idea in a pandemic year. I also think that stress comes from uncertainty, and telling both students and schools to continue as usual through this year might actually be more helpful.
You both have laid out a picture whereby the schools essentially continue and the governments come up with an enlightened way of dealing with what is assessment in a pandemic year. And I suppose I'm asking whether you both feel that the governments are actually looking at it in the way that you are, Anna.
So I'm not a politician, but I am worried about one thing. Once Scotland decided that, for example, the algorithm was not the way to go last summer, the pressure mounted in England and it was almost inevitable that the whole system would unravel. Clearly, there was massive unfairness in the algorithm and it needed careful attention. Ideally, that attention might have come before students were issued with grades, but that required a lot of planning and a lot of careful thought. And obviously what happened in reality was, you know, we switched back to teacher assessment. So my fear going into it this year is careful, considered planning, taking schools, teachers and the public with you is going to be really important as we get through this difficult period, so that at the end of it all, we don't get in a situation where essentially if there's a public outcry about students getting a lower grade, that immediately causes the government to sort of switch to an alternative system at the last minute.
Anna, exams aren't and assessment aren't the only part of education, and we've lost other things as well. Do you think there's a danger of us losing sight of what children who are not in the assessment years have missed out on, or even that those children in assessment years have missed out on that aren't actually due to be assessed?
Well, I'm really conscious that we're talking about GCSEs and A-levels, exams, etc. But the really big story here is the concern we should have about the loss of opportunity to learn that students have experienced. And that's across all years. And obviously, you've also got the fact that, you know, being in school and dealing with a pandemic is stressful for teachers and for parents. So we really need to focus on the fact that what matters most is that we keep as many students in school as much as possible, that they are learning, that we pay attention to their mental health and indeed the mental health of both teachers and parents, and that we sort of try and get through this together with the minimal damage to these kids' schooling that we can achieve. The exams are one measure of it at the end of it, but they're by no means the most important issue that we're facing right now.
Anna Vignol with Laura McInerney, and my conclusion is that the pupils of this pandemic year are going to have special treatment, and their assessment, however done, will have to be tailored to their unique situation. And for the sake of fairness, employers, colleges, whoever, must take this into account. My thanks to Bramman Jeffries, Natalie Pereira, Lindsay Patterson, Anna Vignol and Laura McInerney. We'll be back at the same time the week after next. You've been listening to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. The producers were Kirsty Knight, Bob Howard and Rosamund Jones. The programme was mixed by James Beard and the editor was Jasper Corbett. Another edition of this podcast will be along again soon. And if you enjoyed it, you may find other episodes interesting, including Coronavirus, The Return to School, what we have learned about the virus and what happens if the US election result is contested. You'll find them all on BBC Sounds.
Hello, it's Ray Winstone. I'm here to tell you about my podcast on BBC Radio 4, History's Toughest Heroes. I've got stories about the pioneers, the rebels, the outcasts who define tough.
And that was the first time that anybody ever ran a car up that fast with no tires on. It almost feels like your eyeballs are going to come out of your head.
Tough enough for you? Subscribe to History's Toughest Heroes wherever you get your podcast.